From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, Conversations with Scholars and Visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents part 5 in a series of discussions about literary biography. My guests are Leland Lyons, Leslie Marchand, and Norman Sherry. Prior to his death in the fall of 1983, Leland Lyons was the authorized biographer of William Butler Yeats, the Irish poet and dramatist. Professor Lyons had served as the provost of Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland, and was the author of books and articles about Irish history, culture, and politics. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Professor Lyons worked on his biography of Yeats. Leslie Marchand is Professor Emeritus of English at Rutgers University. He's the author of a 3-volume literary biography of George Gordon, Lord Byron, the English Romantic poet. Professor Marchand is also the editor of a 12-volume edition of Byron's Letters and Journals. Norman Sherry is Mitchell Distinguished Professor of Literature at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He's the authorized biographer of Graham Greene, the British novelist. Professor Sherry recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Here is Leland Lyons.
In the case of Yeats, well, perhaps in the case of any artist, there are actually several biographies that you are writing simultaneously. But in the case of Yeats, he was very much a public man with a public life as well as a private life. And that's a problem, how to marry the two. Is that true of Byron?
Well, Byron was very much a public figure, of course, and his reputation after the publication of Childe Harold in 1812 was such that he couldn't move anywhere without being a public figure. He resented it a bit, of course, as anyone would.
But he also thrived on it.
But he thrived on it too, yes.
But then he at least didn't leave enormous sacks of material behind him. The Yeats problem is exactly the opposite of yours. There's really almost too much material. The letters alone are going to be published in 13 or 14 volumes. And then there are the manuscripts and the notebooks and the letters of the rest of the family and so on. It's a huge archive. This varies very much, but I think it's pretty large in Norman Sherry's case, too.
Yes. I was looking at some letters of Graham Greene that he wrote in a 2-year period. And he had written, in those 2 years, almost 2,000 letters. Now, of course, this creates another problem. How you can't quote from 2,000 letters in over a 2-year period. So you're clearly going to select, and the selection is going to be distortion. How do you prevent yourself distorting material? You are not going to select the flattest letters. You're going to select the most exciting. That in itself is a kind of distortion in writing biography. I don't know how you solve these problems. But of course, one of the huge problems, the biggest problem in our case, I think, certainly I think it's true of Yeats and true of Greene, that you just have too much material.
Give me an instance, if it's possible, in the lives of Byron and Yeats and Greene, of something that you would leave in and something that you would leave out. Mm. And how did you make the decision? I think this comes back, Leland, to the point that you made about the public and the private sides of the figures about whom you write.
Well, with Byron, it's very difficult to leave anything out because
it's all so much fun.
He was so sparkling all the time. Mm-hmm. in his correspondence. I wrote over 1 million words for the 3-volume biography, but I had to cut it in half to have it published. It's simply that the temptation was too great to quote, and when you cut, it hurts too. But it has to be done, and I think it improved the book.
Mm-hmm. One or two examples I could think of would be to do with, well, one particular example to do with a love affair with a woman who's still alive. She's over 80. I've spoken with her and corresponded with her about this. It's quite evident she would prefer it not to be mentioned, or at any rate not to be mentioned in any great detail. And because of that, and because this is one of the gaps in the documentation, it is likely that that will be more lightly treated than some of the other affairs which dot the career of this particular subject.
How much do you have to rely on evidence that's, what's the word, mute? Is there a balance between drawing on documents, evidence where the trail is cold, so to speak, and evidence where you are actually dealing with people who are still alive and who knew your subject?
The historian might be more at home with the documents, I suppose you would expect him to be, but obviously I've done a certain amount of interviewing too, probably not nearly so much as Norman Sherry. I find interviewing sometimes profitable, but really very tricky, because it is so easy to lead the witness. Often you're in the embarrassing situation that you actually know more about what happened in a particular incident than they remember. And you find yourself saying, oh, but it wasn't quite like that, and that destroys confidence immediately, I think.
Mm-hmm. I personally interviewed people all over the world, really, partly because I'm not only interested in those people who knew Green, but those people that Green observed and put into his novels. And the result of that is, for example, that in one case, I went to Mexico 40 years after Graham Greene, followed in the same tracks as Greene, that is to say, down into the rainforests of Tabasco and up into the mountains in Chiapas. And finally there came across, apart from other people, a figure of the Judas figure in Power and the Glory. Green describes him in The Power and the Glory as a person who has a funny laugh and opens his mouth and is gumless, but he has two teeth sticking over like fangs. And clearly Green hated him. Well, I by accident found this man right up in the mountains, and it turned out that he had lost all his teeth by that time, of course, and he was perfectly mad. And he had become a tramp. Originally, when Green knew him, he had been a schoolteacher. The feeling of the extraordinary feeling of walking in someone's footsteps like this, suffering from dysentery 40 years later in exactly the same place as Green's. Even the fleas, I thought, were pretty much the same. Certainly the rats were the same size. And it was really utterly unbelievable, this business. And this is one of the wonders of being a biographer, is that you are able to live within the character, or you try to live within the character of a person much richer in life and character than yourself. And so in some ways it's perfectly marvelous, I think.
I have a phrase that I sometimes use to myself. I wouldn't lay it down as a doctrine, but the mood, if things are going well and you're getting to know the character well, and I'm not just talking about Yeats, but others that I have written about, ironic affection is a mood that often I try to cultivate. You don't always get it, of course. I say ironic affection because if it's simply affection, it becomes cloying, it becomes sentimental, it becomes too one-sided.
How protective are they of themselves? Another way to ask that question is, how aware are they of themselves as the subjects of literary biography?
Well, I sometimes wonder, this is of course an exaggeration and I wouldn't want to be held to it as a matter of scholarly accuracy, but I sometimes have the feeling that Yeats must have envisaged himself as being the subject of a biography almost from about the age of 17 or 18. That is an exaggeration, but certainly the formulation of a myth, the quite deliberate formulation of a myth, the adoption of a series of masks, of different attitudes, that begins very early in his life. And then when he writes his autobiographies and several volumes, which is why I use the plural, although I think in this country perhaps they're usually spoken of as in the singular. But in those autobiographies, he was constructing almost, as it were, an ideal Yeats. And although they are very important, they have to be checked and counterchecked both on matters of fact and indeed on matters of interpretation as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, of course, all human beings are interested in other human beings, point one. So we start from that. Secondly, I think there is this wonderful business of finding buried treasure. And that's what a biographer does, it seems to me. He finds buried treasure. And he pulls it up and he says, look at this. My God, this is something we've never seen before. Mm. And so we gradually get to know a great deal about an author that we would not normally get to know, because the biographer is not restrained as to the nature of his subject and the way in which the subject himself is restrained.
When you say buried treasure, Norman, what specifically might you have in mind? What is All it right. that you're going to tell the public about Graham Greene?
Let me look at it in terms of the way in which Leland Lyons looked at it a moment ago. That is to say, the public man as opposed to the private man. Uh-huh. The ideal, I would have thought, would be to move from the public man to the private man. That is to move, say, to use the title of Graham Greene's first novel, to move to the man within. I don't think that can be done easily. I rather see that what often happens from a writer's point of view, from a biographer, is that though you hang up many mirrors at each corner of the wall, I'm quoting now from Virginia Woolf, in order to get to know your character, still you're still on the outside. You walk round him, I think, rather like an Indian tracker. You go round and round this chap, you see him from all angles, but getting inside him is an impossibility, of course. Even if you know him well, you don't know what his private thoughts are. I mean, to quote Shakespeare, you know, the mind's construction and the face. One can't read this. How do you do this?
Norman was just quoting Virginia Woolf. She also says somewhere, I think, that most biographers preen themselves if they discover 6 or 7 selves in the subject, whereas in fact there may be hundreds, mm-hmm. which is very much the
yes,
same.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
How much do you have to rely on psychology? How much do you psychologize your characters? Was that a problem, for instance, Professor Marchand, in writing about Byron?
Well, if you use common sense psychology, that's about the best you can do. Mm-hmm. I think that...
By that you mean that there are certain psychological doctrines that you would avoid?
No, I mean that the doctrinaire psychologist coming to biography frequently fits his character into a Procrustean bed. And I think I can give you 2 examples of that in the case of Byron. One is Charles Dubose, the Frenchman, Byron and the Need of Fatality, where he ties everything in Byron to that need of fatality.
This is the title of a book.
The title of the book. Uh-huh. The other is Peter Manning's Byron's Fictions, a book published just 2 or 3 years ago, which employs all the devices of the psychologist, the psychoanalyst, in interpreting Byron, but does it with a little common sense, let's say, and doesn't try to fit everything of Byron into one pattern.
Norman?
I must say, I think it's rather an interesting game, this, that certain psychologists play when they write biographies. I can't really think of a good one, frankly. Maybe Erik Erikson's The Young Man Luther. This Procrustean bed, surely this is very true. You see, you can't really ask a work of art questions. You can't put it on the psychiatrist's couch. You can't be inquisitorial. You can't really get anything back. All you can do is to use certain terms. You know, you can say, oh well, this chap suffers from a mother fixation, or sublimations, or an Oedipus complex, or what have you. Well, I don't know what this does. It seems to me to just limit, you know, the creature. Whereas we, if I may say so, much more sensible biographers look for. we don't arrive ready made. We don't look at our characters through a template and say, oh, this is the character it's going to be. We allow the character to emerge after we have very carefully, and for many years, I mean, a dozen years is usually about the time it takes to write a biography, in my view, a dozen years of one's life, collecting material. And when you've collected the material, when you have that vast amount of material, to try to see what comes up in terms of the character. We can refer to chapter and verse, in other words. The psychiatrist can't. The psychiatrist come, biographer can't. Absolute balderdash most of the time, seems to me.
Where does the literary biographer end and the literary critic begin?
I think that perhaps they run in harness all the time, that you're constantly moving from the authentic memories, let's say, to an interpretation of those memories. Hmm. In my own case, what I've decided to do is to keep to a minimum the interpretation until certain portions of the book. It's to say, I've got a chapter which I haven't really written but sketched out of what Green was like at 13 when he was trying manfully to commit suicide. And then I've got a later period at 21 when he'd already tried to the adventure of using Russian roulette, of putting a gun to his head and spinning the chamber around and having a shot at himself. He did that 6 times. At these moments in time, the next one will probably be when he's about 40. So at crucial moments, I do spend a lot of time simply trying to draw together the material and analyze it. So in my case, I am doing that. I have intermission periods. But perhaps a better way is to work, is simply to constantly oscillate between one and the other when you deem it necessary to do so.
I think that's sensible. I haven't been conscious of being a literary critic in my biography, and yet I have commented on Byron's poetry frequently and tried to relate it to his life. And it, with Byron, it isn't too difficult because you can see so clearly from what he himself says in his letters, what he expressed in his poetry. It's interesting to trace the development of ideas in Byron's letters as they found expression in Don Juan, for example. Again and again, you'll find something in the letters that is almost literally incorporated in the poem. What he was thinking, what went through his mind, found expression in poetry very naturally and very quickly.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to part 5 in a series of conversations about literary biography. The panelists are Norman Sherry, Leland Lyons, and Leslie Marchand. Norman Sherry is Mitchell Distinguished Professor of Literature at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He's the authorized biographer of Graham Greene, the British novelist. Leslie Marchand is Professor Emeritus of English at Rutgers University. He's the author of a 3-volume biography of George Gordon, Lord Byron, the English Romantic poet. Prior to his recent death, Leland Lyons had served as provost of Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. He was the authorized biographer of William Butler Yeats, the Irish poet and dramatist. In the spring of 1983, Professors Sherry and Lyons completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where they worked on their respective biographies of Graham Greene and William Butler Yeats. Here is Norman Sherry.
In the case of Greene, of course, you have real difficulties. He's a writer of fiction. And he might very well argue, does, that these characters are purely characters of imagination and have no relationship whatsoever with human beings. But that's only a sop, I think, for his public or for the publishers or for anyone that might say, look here, you put me into this novel. I myself believe, and it seems to me that Green is therefore very close to Byron in this, that however evasive and however much Green may disguise his material, so often one can find even the particular emotional explosion that brought about the possibility of him writing about a particular area and a particular occasion. So I'm sure that if you use care, you can really see how a man's life and the expenses of that life are transformed into his fiction and work both ways. If you're very careful, I think I would even argue that with a work of fiction, it's precisely because it says it's a work of fiction that you might find out a very great deal carefully scrutinizing that fiction in order to add to the known facts of a person's life, unknown facts of a person's life.
As between literary criticism and biography, I, of course, I'm trained as a historian and not as a literary critic, and have never aspired to the latter condition. In fact, I read the critics a lot, and I suppose the first 2 or 3 years when I was preparing for the biography, I read nothing else. The best of the Yeats criticism is superb. A great deal of the rest, one doesn't need, fortunately, to think very much about it. But I have found it helpful in certainly explaining some difficult terms, some actual meanings, helpful in tracing origins to some extent, although it doesn't excuse one having to do that work oneself. But I go to the works and scrutinize them as carefully and minutely as I can, but quite clearly with the object of bringing back from them something different from what the literary critic brings back. And what I want to bring back are the things that seem to me, again, to relate to the man. And I've already used the phrase his intellectual biography. Perhaps I should amend that to say his literary and his intellectual biography, although in the case of Yeats they are interdependent.
A few years ago, the New Critics deprecated autobiographical criticism and maintained in the absolute that you shouldn't look at a man's life at all. You should look at the work. But I think a more sensible attitude has prevailed now, and we look at biography as a useful tool in literary criticism, because often the writer puts more of himself into his work than you would ever find from any facts of diaries or letters or anything else. He feels freer to let himself go, as Byron did. Byron expressed things in his poetry that he never would have expressed to friends, but they were just as true a part of himself. I think you have to consider that evaluating a biographical approach to criticism.
Norman, you have the benefit of being able to talk to your subject.
I do, but that's not always a blessing in disguise.
How does Graham Greene talk to you?
Well, he has said to me that I will not lie to you, Norman, but there are some things I will not tell you. And I think that's pretty much the situation. He often, in the most extraordinary way, I would have said, in spite of what I've just said, I would have said that he is the most honest person I have personally ever met. Rather like Byron, therefore, he will tell things against himself. He is very watchful not to tell things against others. And, of course, inevitably in life he's involved with others. He is a very funny man that way. I mean, I once said to him, who are your enemies, Graham? And I was with his brother, Sir Hugh Greene, at the time, at a railway station. We were going back to London. We'd just been to Berkhamsted, where Graham was born. And Sir Hugh is 6'6", you can imagine that man, and very bald. And if I stood up and he sat down, I could just see his head, which I remember was burnt by the sun. But that's quite irrelevant. But at the end, they started working through, trying to work out the enemies. And it became a game to them. Can you remember X that I met in West Africa? He was an enemy. Could Norman write to him? Jolly good. They obviously wanted to unearth these enemies for me. And so it became something very funny. But he did make this point. He said, unlike you, Norman, I do not work in an institution. I do not need to fraternize with enemies. Which I thought was quite a point, you know. But he has it. That shows that he has a sense of humor. And one thinks of Greene as not having a sense of humor, you know, being always dealing with these hunted creatures who bring themselves to suicide, or, you know, etc. But he certainly had. He told me the last time I was with him a very funny story. And may I tell it to you, therefore, even though it's not entirely relevant. It is, in a sense. It gives an indication of his character that people do not know. He said he was at Meyer's house. Michael Meyer is the biographer of Ibsen, and is now writing the biography of Strindberg, in fact, and finding it rather tough going, I believe. Meyer's wasn't in the room, so he was looking at the telephone book. He always seems to read telephone books and directories, extraordinary, or maps, or what have you. These are the things that fascinate him. And he looked up his own name, and he came across it in London. So at once he was on the phone, and he picked up the phone and he said, is that Graham Greene, to this chap who is also called Greene in London? And the man said, yes. And he said, Ah, you're the author of all those obscene novels. And the man immediately got very upset and said, no, I'm not that Graham Greene. And Greene, the real Greene, said to him, I think it's an act of cowardice not willing to stand up for the things that you wrote. The man changed his number, I believe. From moving from the quiet groves of academe into the tropical and eccentric world of Graham Greene has been a most astonishing thing. And I must say that to be a biographer of Greene is something that makes me at times not sleep well. I wonder if, for example, since my next journey is to leper colonies in Zaire, and since Greene almost lost his life there, and I anticipate losing mine, whether he won't need another biographer.
Well, I didn't want us to end completely on an elegiac note. I think one has to say that there are enormous rewards as well. If you're living day in, day out in the company of a man of most extraordinary talent and striking personality, that in itself is a tremendous reward. And also, it's a great challenge. I mean, it's the most difficult thing you're likely to be asked to do in your life. And to try to respond to that, it can be stimulating. There are these awful dark nights of the soul, which may go on for months, but you hope to come out of that.
Well, the rewards, as I see them in my case, are that I owe a great deal to Byron because he has introduced me to interesting people all over the world, and he has given me a chance to travel usefully in his footsteps, and altogether, I think the rewards are far outweigh the disadvantages.
In some ways, what I personally find wonderful about being a biographer is that you certainly extend the scope of your existence and your life. And you're getting to know someone in a way that you get to know no other person. I think there's no other person in the world that you'll ever get to know as well as you know that particular person. Even though you don't know that personality, it's still a mystery, but you get a glimpse of the mystery. And you have almost a godlike quality, it seems to me, that you're bringing someone from the dead back into life so that he breathes again. That's surely perfectly wonderful, that you have that wonderful authority. Seems to me to be one of the greatest and most moving pleasures that one has in life.
From the National Humanities Center, the program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond with the fifth segment in a series of discussions about literary biography. My guests were Norman Sherry of Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, Leslie Marchand, Professor Emeritus of English at Rutgers University, and the late Leland Lyons of Trinity College, Dublin, Ireland. Next week, Soundings on Literary Biography continues with a conversation about Ezra Pound. My guest will be Walton Litz, Professor of English at Princeton University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for part 5 in the Soundings series on literary biography. This week, the authorized biographers of Lord Byron, William Butler Yeats, and Graham Greene. Leslie Marchand of Rutgers University, Norman Sherry of Trinity University, and Leland Lyons of Trinity College in Dublin discuss biographical evidence, the uses of psychology, the dividing lines between chronicle and interpretation, and consider the perils and rewards in literary and biographical scholarship. The Art of Literary Biography, Part 5, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.